Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. If you've got your Bibles this morning, let's go ahead and find 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel chapter 19. We are going to be very ambitious this morning, as we are going to attempt to make it all the way through chapter 19 and 20. Yes, I promise we will not be here. I promise we won't be here too long. Maybe that's probably more accurate. No. Way before then. The reason it's 66 verses, so that's a lot to go through. But the reason that I wanted to do 19 and 20 together is really it's all one story. It's kind of a continuation of really almost one or two days' events. 3 days, really. 3 days. So 19 and 20 really cover 3 days worth of events, and they all carry the same idea. And in some sense, if you wanted to know what chapter 19 and 20 is all about, we could really define it in one sentence. Now, we're going to work through it this morning because I think there's a few things that we can take home from it. But really, the idea is Saul tries to kill David. Right? That's kind of the overarching idea is Saul tries to kill David. Right? And so over the course of 3 days, we're going to kind of look at how all of that. Now, we're not going to read all 66 verses. We're going to be very expeditious. And we're going to just talk about the paragraphs as they come. And then at the end, I want to draw four main ideas that also will serve kind of as our application for today as well. So it's kind of main idea application all at one time this morning. All right, sound good? All right, everybody got their listening ears on? Because we got to go quickly, all right? All right, so as chapter 19 opens, it's kind of, after the battle of Goliath, David and Goliath, and after David has rose to prominence, and last week we saw that Saul did not like David being acclaimed more than him. You know, the statement was Saul has killed his thousands and David his tens of thousands, and Saul was okay up until he heard the women in the streets crying out that, and then he got jealous, and that jealousy turned into fear, and that fear caused some irrational actions, in which we're going to see more of that today. In fact, last week we saw that what Saul tried to do was in private. Last week, Saul tried to kill David by throwing a spear at David twice, and he missed him. But nobody else is in the room. Today, we're going to see at the very beginning, Saul takes his efforts to the next level. In fact, Saul openly tells Jonathan, and the text says, all his servants, go kill David. I mean, it's almost like if you've watched any of those mafia movies where they put out a hit on somebody, and it's like they don't matter, they don't care who does the hit as long as the hit gets done. That's kind of what Saul is doing in this, because he said the text is clear. He tells Jonathan and all his servants go kill David. Now Jonathan, who is David's best friend, goes, whoa, wait a minute. And he talks his father off the ledge, so to speak. And in fact, here's how the chapter ends. Here's how this first section ends. Read it with me. It's on the screen. And Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan. So Saul is like, hey, all y'all, go kill David. And Jonathan's like, no, that's not a good idea. The law says this is not a good idea. And Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan. And Saul swore, as the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death. Right? That's how the story ends. That's how that first section ends. The next verse goes on to say that in verse 8, there was war. And again, what did David have, success or failure? He had great success, right? And then we see the next section starts in chapter 19, verses 9 through 17. And Saul again is being tormented by this spirit from the Lord. And David is doing what David does. He's trying to help Saul out. He's trying to soothe Saul's soul by playing the lyre. And guess what Saul does again? Tries to pin him to the wall with the spear. As we will see, Saul really loves that spear. Right? And the text tells us that as he tries, it gives us the idea that as Saul tries to pin David to the wall with the spear, that the spear actually gets stuck in the wall. And so David is able to flee. But this time, David returns to his home where his wife named Michal is there waiting for him. Now, she doesn't know what's going on, but he tells her. And so she's at home, and so they devise a plan to escape because they both kind of agree that if you stay here till dark, you're going to die. You know, Saul's going to get you. And so she helps David, lowers him out of a window, and he runs to the city called Ramah, which is about 3 miles away, which is where Samuel the prophet still lives. So Michal helps lower David out of the window. He runs away to go see Samuel. In the meantime, though, after he's left, now there's a little interesting side note in here. We don't have a whole lot of time to talk about this, but she takes, which had been quite large, a household idol, yes, like idolous statue, puts it in the bed, like covers it up with the covers, and is going to pretend that that's David asleep in the bed. Right? Foolproof idea, right? So, Saul finds out that David's at home, so he sends his servants to go watch the house, and they eventually go up and knock on the door and say, "Hey, we need to see David." And what does Michal say? Classic line, "He's sick." And not wanting to barge into the king's daughter's house, the messengers are kind of, you can kind of read in between, like, "Well, I don't know, what are we going to do now?" So they go back to Saul. And Saul, in essence, says, "Bring David here, bed and all. If you got to bring him in the bed, bring the bed too." It reminded me of this funny story when I was in college. I thought about it this morning. We had this one friend in college, so... And I want you to kind of capture in your mind this setting. It's seven guys, seven college guys. Okay, capture. Cleanliness, not high on the priority list. You know, anyway, stanky, dirty clothes everywhere. You know, but seven of us lived in the, it was basically like a double wide trailer. They had divided out into four rooms with two bathrooms and kind of a hall in the middle. And so there's like a hall here and there's two rooms here, and bathrooms right here. So my buddy, I had a roommate, and so there was one of us that didn't have a roommate, obviously. There was a total of eight could live there, but we only had seven. One guy didn't have a roommate. That's another story for another day, why his roommate had to be asked to leave college. Hilarious story. But anyway, that's another day. But my one friend, Greg was a notorious hard sleeper. My roommate, a feather could fall on the ground and he would wake up. Greg's roommate, my other friend, same way. And that friend was very like, up in the morning, bright and early, like, "Oh, let's go." The rest of us weren't like that, especially me. But anyway, Greg, my friend Jeremy was over there. "Greg, wake up. Greg, wake up." Alarm just going off. "Greg, wake up. Greg, wake up." Because we all had classes together. So it's like we got to go to breakfast and class and all that. Greg wouldn't wake up. For love nor money, he would not wake up. And so one of us had the great idea of, let's take the mattress with Greg in it off the bed and go put it in the back of the truck and we'll just drive Greg to class. Great idea, right? It sounded great to us. We got Greg all the way in the back of the truck. Mattress, it was a twin mattress, slid right great in the back of that truck. We were literally quietly opening the door and about whoever's truck it was, it wasn't mine, about to get in and crank the car. And here old sleepyhead Greg wakes up, mad as a hornet. "What are y'all doing?" And we were like, "Man, you wouldn't wake up. We had to get you to class somehow." Well, he was mad the whole day, as you can imagine. That's what I was thinking about when I read Saul's word, "Bring David, bed and all." Saul was like, "I don't care how you have to get him there. I don't care if he's on his deathbed, sick, or pretending. Bring him here." So the servants rush up, going to bring the whole bed back to Saul. Well, guess what? David ain't in the bed, is he? He's 3 miles away. So Saul is furious at his daughter, basically accusing her of treason against him. And so Saul has a decision to make. Right? He's tried to kill David one time with the spear. Then he's done sent assassins to the house to bring him back, bed and all, if they have to. And that hadn't worked. And now he's learned that David's 3 miles away. Now, you know, he's at an inflection point. What do I do? Do I just say, hey, well, clearly this ain't working. Let's try again. Or does he pursue? Well, Saul being Saul says, hey, let's go after him again. So Saul sends three consecutive groups of messengers. The first group of messenger goes, and they don't return. So Saul's like, well, send another one. So he sends another group of messengers. They don't return. Sends a third group of messengers, and they don't return. Now, the reason they don't return is because the place where David has gone, when he reaches Ramah, him and Samuel get together, and Samuel takes David to this place called Naoth. Now, scholars aren't exactly sure what Naoth is or exactly where it is. It could be kind of like a suburb of Ramah, or it could be a specific like community within Ramah. They're not really sure. But regardless, they are all sure of what it does or functions as. And it functions as a prophetic stronghold. So the prophets, God's spokespersons on earth during this period, there's a group of them there. So when each of these three consecutive messenger groups from Saul reach Naoth, they begin to be overtaken by the Spirit of the Lord, and they begin to speak God's truth to everybody. So they begin to speak God's truth. So they're over. So they cannot complete their mission. They cannot complete their assignment. So Saul is obviously wondering why three consecutive groups haven't come back with David. And so the way I looked at it as, he probably was thinking what some of you would be thinking. Well, if you want something done right, you got to do it yourself. So what does Saul do? Saul tears off 3 miles away from his home in Gibeah to go find David. And as he gets close, he talks to some people. And they say, oh, him and Samuel are at Naoth in Ramah. And so he goes. But the text is very clear that before Saul gets to Naoth, he is overcome by the Spirit as well. Now, notice the difference. The three messenger groups did not become overcome by the Spirit until they reached Naoth, until they actually got there. But Saul is overtaken by the Spirit before he even gets there. He's so overtaken by the Lord that the text tells us that he humiliates himself in front of the people, takes all his clothes off, and yes, is walking around naked, speaking God's truth. So much so that people wonder, has Saul become one of the prophets? Right? Well, that's how chapter 19 ends. But chapter 20 picks up the same storyline with what David is doing immediately after. When David realizes that these messenger groups and Saul himself have made it to Naoth in Ramah, he hightails it out of there. And chapter 20 tells us that he goes to find his best friend Jonathan, because maybe, just maybe, Jonathan can help him. Right? So David finds Jonathan, and David and Jonathan begin to talk. And David is like, hey, bud, it's paraphrasing here, your dad's trying to kill me. He says, do you know, Jonathan, if I have sinned against your father in some way? Because if I have, like, let me know. And Jonathan's like, no, I don't know anything. But Jonathan says, hey, let's come up with a plan for how we can solve this problem. Now, some of you, if you read through this, and I hope you go back and read through chapter 19 and 20, because, again, we're just hitting the peaks of the highlights here. Some of you may be wondering, like I was wondering when I was reading it, I mean, does Jonathan not know that his father is trying to kill him? Like, come on. But then it hit me. Jonathan, the last time Jonathan is in this storyline is in verse 6. Still on the screen. Look at it. And what does Saul say to Jonathan? As the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death. Jonathan doesn't know about the second time Saul tried to pin his best friend to the wall. Jonathan doesn't know that David ran back to his house and Saul sent servants to kill him there, bed and all. Jonathan doesn't know that David ran away to Ramah and Saul sent three groups of messengers to go get him, and then when they didn't come back, he went himself. Jonathan is oblivious to all of that. Jonathan doesn't come up in that part of the story. So all he knows is that his dad, the last time David was talk of the town between them two, Jonathan heard his father say, as the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death. So Jonathan is naturally overtaken because the last thing he heard was his father say, hey, I'm not going to kill David. And now David's going, hey man, your dad's out to kill me. So Jonathan is like, all right, maybe he is, maybe he isn't. But let's formulate a plan to figure this thing out. And so David and Jonathan hatch this plan of how they can figure out Saul's intent. And so there's this ritual feast that's about to happen around a new moon that happened every month. And the plan they devise is that David is not going to attend that feast, nor is he going to attend the next meal. Now remember, David is Saul's son-in-law. So they were commonly found eating together. They would eat meals together as a family. And so Jonathan says, hey, I'll be at the feast. I'll be at the next meal. And I will, this is my phrase, I'll run cover for you. And we'll see how Saul reacts. If Saul reacts positively, we know he's not trying to kill you. If he reacts negatively, we know that he is trying to kill you. All right, so here's what happens. So they've hatched a plan. David's going to go hide. Jonathan will eventually report back to David what the events turn out. So the day of the ritual feast, David doesn't show up. And the text tells us that Saul doesn't think twice about it, really. He just thinks, oh, well, maybe David is ritually unclean and he can't eat at this specific meal, but like surely he'll be back tomorrow. So day one, uneventful. Nothing to report. Day two out, however, things take a dramatic turn because when David doesn't show up again two nights in a row to eat dinner, Saul becomes irate. And Jonathan, remember, what's his role? He's running cover. Says to Saul, well, hey, Dad, here's what's going on. David he's gone off to his family's house in Bethlehem, and this is happening, and that's why he's not here. And Saul, like, blows up, loses it. And let me see if we can read the verses here. In chapter 20, verse 30. Chapter 20, verse 30. Here's what Saul says. Now listen. You read your Bible, look, it's on the screen. Here we go. Then Saul's anger was kindled against who? Jonathan. Now look what he says to Jonathan. You son of a perverse and rebellious woman. Now I wanted to stop right there and go, now why are you bringing his mama up into this? His mama ain't got nothing to do with this. Right? Come on, Saul. You son of a perverse, rebellious woman. I wondered, is mama there? Did she give him the eye? Like, did they have words afterwards? Like, anyway. Do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and the shame of your mother's nakedness again? Like, mama ain't got nothing to do with this, right? Why are you? Saul's just everybody. He's just throwing stones at everybody, right? Well, what happens next is Jonathan tries to reason with his father, but Saul is not having it. In verse 33, look what happens. In verse 33, Saul, who again loves that spear, takes his spear, and the text tells us, but Saul hurled his spear at him, at Jonathan, to strike him. So Jonathan knew that his father was determined to put David to death. In verse 34, and Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger, ate no food at the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had disgraced him. Right? So, is Saul out for David's life? Yes. Now, the story, here's how the story finishes. Jonathan, and they've already, you can go back and read this, have figured out a way to report to David what the incident is, and they do that is through shooting arrows and saying something to a specific servant who's going to collect the arrows. And so David and Jonathan have this wonderful, amazing scene at the very end of chapter 20, and they meet each other. David bows down, like as Jonathan and him are meeting. Jonathan, he sees Jonathan, he literally lays down on the ground and gets up and lays down on the ground and gets up and lays down on the ground. He like bows before Jonathan three times, just as a side note, in case you're ever in Bible trivia. This is obviously an act of great respect and great admiration for the person you're bowing down to. But in the Old Testament, no one does this more than David does right here for a single person. So it's a sign of great, great respect for Jonathan. Jonathan reciprocates that sign of respect and loyalty with a kiss, which would have been traditional in their culture. And they basically come together and they've already made a covenant with each other earlier. But the story ends in verse 42. With these words right here. It says, they make a covenant between each other, and it says, the Lord shall be between me and you, and here's the new part, and between my offspring and your offspring. In other words, David and Jonathan are making a covenant that will outlast both of them and will go in to their family, their children, and their children's children. And so what we see here is even amid the rocky road of the story, it ends on a high note because David and Jonathan, this covenant they make, will literally outlast them, literally. And it will not be just for them, but it will be for them and their children. And we'll see in the future how that story plays out because David absolutely upholds his end of the bargain. Now, here's the sad part of this exchange is Jonathan and David, even though they're best friends, they have protected each other, they have helped each other out, they've been loyal to each other. They will only see each other one more time before Jonathan is killed in battle. And so this is kind of the it. This is it. David's about to go off into kind of a quote-unquote wilderness journey, which we're going to talk about briefly in just a second. But we'll start next week. It's kind of the next evolution in the David cycle in 1 Samuel is what's David going to do now that he realizes he's got to leave his family, his friends, his wife, everybody. And he's going to kind of go off in the quote-unquote wilderness in this journey. And we'll see how he comes out. So that's the story of chapter 19 and 20. See, Saul tries to kill David. Over the course of 3 days, Saul has tried to kill David 3 times, right? And so out of that, I think there are 4 kind of key ideas that this story relates to you and me today. All right, so let's talk about them. Number one, key idea number one is that David is following in the footsteps of previous men of God. In other words, now that David is going to go in this wilderness journey, it sounds very familiar to other stories we've read in the Old Testament or that you can read in the Old Testament. For example, Abraham. Abraham is called to leave his father and mother and his family in Haran and journey to a land he doesn't even know. Right? Abraham's grandson, Jacob. What does Jacob have to do? After he steals his brother Esau's birthright and blessing, he has to flee and go back to his granddad's homeland in Haran and stays there for years before he comes back. Jacob's son Joseph, y'all remember what happened to him? If you don't, you can read it in Genesis. Joseph is forced to go on this wilderness type journey because his brothers sell him into slavery. Moses, the great leader of the exile, who is the prince of Egypt, what does he do? He's forced to go live in the wilderness for 40 years. But here's the amazing thing. Every one of those guys who goes on this wilderness exile journey, they all come back deeply changed by the Lord. When Abraham leaves Haran, he's pretty much a pagan. He's pagan. But by the time the end of the story of his life happens, Abraham is no longer a pagan, but the text tells us that that his faith is counted to him as righteousness. Right? In other words, his belief in God and his faith in God is made him right with God. Jacob is a trickster, a manipulator, a master manipulator. But what does he do when he returns back to see his brother? Humble, bows down before him. Life's changed, right? Joseph, when he goes off, what is he? Arrogant, proud little brother. Coat of many colors story? Y'all all going to bow down before me. You can see it, little brother poking out his chest. Y'all going to bow down before me. But what does he do after he's been in Egypt? You're thinking the story. I mean, you and I know how, we know how this story goes. Brothers come back. Ah, ha, ha, ha. What does Joseph do? Shows him grace and mercy. Moses, prince of Egypt, learned, goes off. What does he come back? The leader of God's people to take them out of Egypt. Now, the question is, how is this going to affect David? Well, we don't know yet. We haven't read the rest of the story together. We'll have to see. But what we can say at this point is David is following in the footsteps of other great men of God in the Old Testament. Here's the second thing we learn about this passage, and this is evident all over the place, is Jonathan's loyalty to David. If you want a picture of loyalty in the Old Testament, I don't think you can find a greater place than Jonathan's loyalty to David. Let's read chapter 20, verses 13 through 15 together. Here's what it says. But should it please, this is Jonathan speaking to David, should it please my father to do you harm? The Lord do so to Jonathan and more also, if I do not disclose it to you and send you away that you may go in safety. Listen, may the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. And listen to verse 14 and 15. I love these. If I am still alive, in other words, if we do this and I make it out, show me the steadfast love of the Lord. That's covenant, faithfulness, love of God, that I may not die. Do not cut off your steadfast love from my house forever when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. In other words, what is Jonathan admitting right here? My dad, he's on the decline. You, David, are on the incline. I can see God's hand is on you, and it is not on my father. And I'm asking you to do what no one else in your place would do. And that would be, let a rival claimant to the throne live. You go read history. What do most kings do when they take the throne and there are other rivals that could take the throne? They all disappear. It happens even in the Old Testament. And Jonathan is saying, hey, bud, please don't do that for me. Show me the steadfast love of the Lord that the Lord has shown you. Right? And we'll see how that plays out. I was thinking about this today. I don't think there's a better Old Testament example, or I was thinking about it this week. I don't think there's a better Old Testament example of Jesus' words in John 15, 13 than Jonathan's actions in this passage. Jesus says in John 15, 13, greater love has none than this, than a man lay down his life for his friend. Then Jesus goes on to tell the disciples in the last night he's with them, and you are my friends. Right? Because Jesus knows he's about to go to the cross. There's not a greater Old Testament example of what it means to lay down your life for a friend than Jonathan right here. Because literally, Jonathan almost got killed by his own father by that dadgum spear. I mean, somebody should have took the spear away from Saul. Like, did nobody think, hey, we should probably lose that thing? Right? You know, like that kid's toy that's annoying you to death? It just somehow disappears, you know? Jonathan was loyal. Point number three, God is still on the throne in Israel. No matter what Saul does, no matter how he tries to throw out God's plan, and no matter how he tries to change the trajectory of David, Saul is no match for God. None. Saul, listen to me. Saul might be the king with a capital K, but God is the all caps king. And there's nothing Saul can do about that. Saul might be the king of Israel, but God is the king of the world. And no matter how Saul tries to change things in his favor or to do what he wants to do, he is no match for God. Now, this is not in your outline. This is free. What should this teach us about our culture and world today? That it doesn't matter who the president is. It doesn't matter who the Speaker of the House is. It doesn't matter who the majority leader is. It doesn't matter what despotic dictator in a foreign country, who they are or what they do. They will never be able to thwart God's plan. Never. Now, I know most of us, we get all bent out of shape if our political party don't win and they don't do what we think they ought to do. But at the end of the day, none of them, none is stopping God's plan of action. And the next big thing on God's calendar is not a government shutdown or reopen. It is Jesus coming back. And it does not matter what they do. Christian, listen. Muslim leaders in Nigeria are killing, literally butchering our fellow Christians in Nigeria to death. And no matter how hard they try to stamp out Christianity, they will never accomplish their ultimate goal because they cannot stop God's church. They cannot stop God's mission. They cannot stop Christ returning and being on the literal throne of earth. They can't stop it. They can try, but they cannot make it. And we see that played out right here in chapter 20. All right? Now, last thing, point number four. This passage, chapter 19 and 20, is a clear and concise, overwhelmingly clear definition of the downward spiral of sin. Now, I want to walk back with you for just a minute, okay? I want to walk back with you just for a minute to last week. Well, really, to chapter 17. Because in chapter 17, we saw the mediocrity, we talked about this last week, the mediocrity of Saul's reign in clear display. He had 40 days to do something about Goliath, and he chose to do nothing. Right? He didn't lead well. They languished. And then David comes on the scene, and David says, I'll take care of Goliath. And with God's help, he does. David trusted in the Lord. Saul didn't. Saul gets jealous. And what did we say last week? Saul got jealous. Not because David necessarily defeated Goliath and had success. We said he got jealous because Saul could have had the same results that David did, but he was unwilling to do what David was willing to do. Saul was unwilling to trust in the Lord. David trusted in the Lord. Right? So Saul gets jealous. He doesn't do anything about his jealousy. And it turns into fear. And that fear turns into delusion, hysteria, and bad decisions. First, he tries to kill David with a spear and nobody knows. Then he tries to manipulate David through his daughters. Terrible idea as a father, by the way. Terrible. Then he escalates and says, now I'm going to involve more people in this plot. Because at the beginning of chapter 19, what does he do? Tells David and all of his servants, I got a hit put out on David. I don't care who does it, just do it. Then when that doesn't work, he tries to kill David again with a spear. When David flees, bring him bed and all into the king. And when that doesn't work, what does he do? He keeps going. He sends wave after wave of servants. And with that doesn't work, he tries to do it himself. And then when that doesn't work, he tries to kill his own son. Several months ago, probably at this point, Pastor Logan went through the book of James with our teenagers. And one of the verses they read, and our teenagers may remember this verse, James 1, 14 through 15 says this, but each person is tempted, listen, when he is carried away by his own desires, then listen to the imagery here. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it's fully grown, brings forth death. This is a perfect example of what's going on, or perfect definition of what's going on in chapter 19 and 20. Saul's own desire to kill and murder his greatest general, his son's best friend, his own desire to kill David bred death in his life over and over and over and over again. When it was conceived, it turned into sin, and when it was brought forth, it brought forth death in Saul's life. And that is exactly what happened. Now, it's going to take a while to get there, right? But ultimately, that is what will bring down Saul's downfall, bring Saul's downfall into action. When I was a kid, I remember Second Baptist Church, Warner Robins, Georgia. I was sitting about where Mr. Sunny, Miss Don are, second or third row. It was on a Sunday night because at that time we had co-pastors. And so one, he would preach on Sunday morning and Wednesday night, and the other guy would preach the early service on Sunday and Sunday night. It was really great. Vastly different styles of preaching. One, the guy who preached on Sunday night, Mike Everson, he preached through, like we do, preached through passages of Scripture exegetically. Get my words right here. All right. And one night, in a sermon similar to this, talking about sin, he made a statement. And that statement has stuck with me since I was a kid. And it is a clear and concise statement of what's happening in this. Here's the statement. Listen to me. I hope you remember it like I did. Sin will take you further than you want to go. It will keep you longer than you want to stay. And it will cost you more than you want to pay. Sin will keep you longer than you want to stay. It will cost you more than you want to pay. Right? All of those things are true. It will keep you longer than you want to stay. It'll take you further than you want to go. It'll cost you more than you want to pay. All of those things are true. And they, if we're honest, they've been true in our own life. Oh, I'll just do this for a while, and I'll eventually get right with the Lord. And then eventually get right with the Lord is decades. And one sin turns into two, and two turns into four, and four turns into 20. And before long, you're so far away from the Lord that you don't even recognize yourself or where you used to be. And that is exactly what is going on in this story. Saul's own sin is taking him further than he probably ever wanted to go or thought he would go. He started out jealous, and now he's trying to kill everybody. I mean, if this is modern day, look, if they made this story into a docudrama that you watched on Netflix or Amazon Prime, you and I would both go, Saul is a psychopath. Right? His rap sheet would be a mile long, multiple attempted murders. I mean, there's probably some criminal like mafia laws, or some RICO laws being, organized crime laws, assault. I mean, all of this stuff. Sin will take you further than you thought you would go. It'll keep you longer than you want to stay. This will dominate the rest of Saul's life. Because I'm going to kind of give you a little preview of where we're going to go. Saul's currently himself, his servants, and his son, he's tried to involve, his daughters, some more servants. He's about to involve an entire army. Think about that. Instead of defending the nation, you're pursuing one guy and his little group of merry men. Right? Sin will cost you, take you further than you want to go, keep you longer than you want to stay, and it will cost you more than you want to pay. This will eventually take Saul's life. And listen to me, friends. This is where it becomes really, really relevant for you and I today. Here's the question. What sin right now is costing you more than you want to pay, keeping you longer than you want to stay, and taking you further than you want to go. And you may say, well, I don't feel like there's really anything right now in my life. Okay, that's good. But just keep your eyes open and your mind sharp, because one day there will be something. And listen to me, if we don't deal with that right now, we'll look 2, 3, 5, 6, 10 years down the road and we'll go like, man, I wish I would have dealt with that sooner. In my own personal life, I can go ahead and tell you, there has never been a time where God has convicted me of sin that I said, boy, I wish I wouldn't have done that when He convicted me the first time. You know what I'm saying? Like, oh, I wish I would have stayed in that sin longer. Not one. Not one. But there's been a lot of times I've been like, I wish I would have dealt with that sooner. I wish I wouldn't have been obedient sooner. Right? This story is a clear and concise example of what the downward spiral of sin causes in our life. So here's kind of we're about to end the service. See, I told you I'd get you out on time. Right? Mr. Ernie's going to come up. Ms. Reba's going to lead us in hymn response. And the question here that I've got for you this morning, that I got for all of us is what sin in your life do you need to deal with today? I don't know what it is. You know what it is. Or what temptation in your life? Maybe even this. There's not a sin in your life, but like, what temptation in your life do you need to be like, hey, I need to go ahead and nip that in the bud? To quote Barney Fife, nip it. Which one do I need to nip right now? With the Lord's help, the Holy Spirit's power, do I need to nip right now? That way it doesn't grow into something more in the future.
Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.